Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Law. I'm your host, Nick Posick. Today, I'm joined by guests Christina Moggs and Yu Jiuju to discuss their recent book, Heritage Politics in China, The Power of the Past. This book examines the impact of heritage policies and discourses on the Chinese state and Chinese society. It sheds light on the way Chinese heritage policies have transformed the narratives and cultural practices of the past to serve the interests of the present. Yu Jiuju and Christina Moggs, welcome to New Books in Law. I'm thrilled you can join me to discuss heritage politics in China, the power of the past.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Hi, Nick. Thank you very much for the invitation.
So I enjoyed this book immensely. And my first question for you is, why write this book and why now?
Yeah, about 10 years ago, when I was writing my last book on ethnic tourism in Southwest China, I probably believe Christina also had a similar experience, that I had a chance to travel around the country and notice that there's a growing national interest in cultural heritage and Chinese past. And in the past decades, China is very active in nominating heritage on the UNESCO World Heritage Program. Branding and listing something as World Heritage or intangible heritage has become an important cultural industry. And you might also find that on a global domestic level, whenever you go in China, almost every province, city, and towns are doing something about cultural heritage. If you're asking us why we're doing this project now, I think it's just become a national phenomenon that local government has facilitated urban renewal of historic cities for the purpose of city branding. They're also passionate to organizing some kind of intangible heritage festivals or fairs to promote local handicrafts, food, and cultural customs. And in the meantime, there has been a rapid emergence of private museums and the collections and people who are passionate in collecting and displaying ancient objects. Why you might also find that universities are running conferences and research projects on topics related to cultural heritage or help governments in documenting, listing.
You describe it in the book, actually, as a heritage craze or a heritage boom, a heritage fever, and it's something that I know it comes up a lot in your work, actually, Yuja. Could you explain to our listeners how exactly this idea of heritage exists in China's public imagination?
Right. This is, in a book we call it Chinese heritage fever, and other scholars might call it heritage boom or craze. This is a it's not only about, I mean, this back to the question of what is heritage is. And most of the people would think about heritage in a certain sense of monuments, ancient cultural collections or objects. And what we define and what Chinese people think about or imagination of heritage is a very kind of culture idea of cultural heritage, which it refers to a very wide definition of heritage. Anything refers to the past, whether it refers to as a cultural production of heritage. And so it could be something about ancient objects, but it could also be enzyme parks, which refers to ancient music or some kind of ancient handicrafts making. But its interest is that this idea of preserving and collecting ancient objects about and this kind of fascination of the Chinese past was not new to China. And in ancient China, we found that heritage practices were often related to royal collections, documentation, knowledge transmission, and history writing. So you can find from the last maybe 4,000 or 5,000 years, Chinese civilization has been transmitted through the learning of texts and images and the passing on of objects. But what new today, if you ask us the imagination of heritage in Chinese public, I think it's the scope, the scale, the strategies and innovation and motivation, sorry. So I think Christina has some ideas about that political motivation and the political strategy particularly.
That's great. So Christina, yes, please do, because politics obviously and political strategy is very much a part of your book, right? The subtitle of it, The Power of the Past, right? We always hear the power of used in this kind of gentle, innocuous way, but yours suggests that's part of a much more complex political strategy for China.
Yes, absolutely. And that kind of ties in what Uji was just talking about, because on the one hand, heritage, and that could be, you know, in any country really, is often a tool by, you know, that is used by the government for nation building, for creating a national identity, for supporting, you know, pride in the nation, fostering, you know, some form of nationalism as well. But in China, it goes even further than that, because the Chinese past has been criticized for so long, has been repressed, especially during the, you know, the Mao era, so the communist times. And now there's really this fever also, because people really want to connect to the past and really want to kind of think about who they are and be proud of the imperial times that were often criticized. So therefore now the Chinese government is using this and promoting heritage to this extent, because it wants to you know, foster this nationalism. And that's really one key strategy here. But then on the other hand, and this is why we included a case study on ethnic minority regions in China, is that it also ties together the Chinese nation state, which is very much diverse ethnically speaking. So you have so many different regions, you have 55 ethnic groups, and having a national heritage is really also a tool to, you know, support ethnic minority governance, because you can integrate all of these different ethnic minorities into one kind of national past, one national kind of narrative. And the Chinese party state assumes the responsibility of protecting this national or ethnic minority heritage and the sites, cultural practices, but also kind of gains power over kind of interpreting their meaning and displaying them. So it kind of takes over the management of that. And then I think a third reason is that heritage, as Uji also just said, is very much related to the tourism industry, cultural industry, and fostering heritage is not only good for kind of governing people and governing kind of, or kind of fostering national identities, but it's also good for economic development, because, you know, tourists go to heritage sites, go to museums, you know, they pay for accommodation, transport, food, leisure. So all of that is really a big, big industry. And that, again, also fosters kind of support for the Chinese government, because it's very much about kind of a, we call it that, like a performance-based legitimacy. So the Chinese government is very much based, or its legitimacy is based on being able to, you know, promote and enable continuous economic growth. And the heritage industry, because it's become so important, is a key pillar here. And I think finally, kind of moving outside of China, I think on the international level, so the promotion and international recognition of Chinese heritage through, you know, UNESCO World Heritage Site listings, but also through just cultural exchange programs and all of that, fosters kind of China's cultural soft power worldwide, which again, to national pride and nationalism on the domestic level. So therefore, I would say that heritage has become a key tool for the Chinese government, because it fosters many objectives that are really key. But I think the UNESCO is really important here to mention because, you know, while the Chinese government can do whatever perhaps that it wants domestically and really try to use and the heritage domestically for, you know, domestic purposes, on the UNESCO level, UNESCO kind of through its listings of world heritage can kind of recognize and legitimize what is done domestically. And so, for instance, if the Chinese government lists the Potala Palace in Tibet, then the UNESCO actually recognizes Chinese sovereignty over Tibet. And it also is very much these World Heritage Site listings or listings of intangible cultural heritage foster cultural soft power, you know, kind of the attractiveness of Chinese culture worldwide, and therefore also, you know, promotes, again, national pride domestically. So I would say that while heritage feeds into meeting many different kinds of objectives, all of them together fostered the legitimacy of the one-party state because people kind of support the government because it brings economic development, kind of social stability, and kind of enhances pride in the nation. So therefore, heritage is a key strategy in, you know, by the Chinese government to, you know, promote itself as kind of the guardian of the past.
And to demonstrate this, you zeroed in case studies of very specific sites, and sites that you mentioned tourism earlier. I think a lot of people that might have been on tours of China or have a general familiarity with China might know Xi'an, Lijiang, Nanjing, you know, all big cities, all with rich histories. How did you select these sites in particular? And tell me about your research process for examining these sites.
One of the main reasons we select these sites is that we intend to examine different perspective heritage in various contexts in China. So just like Kristina mentioned, that we like to show that heritage is not only a cultural production of the past, it's also a political project that refers to power, equality, and social justice. It has political and social consequence on people's life, particularly local communities who originally own those cultural heritage. So when we are looking at different sites, even as we mentioned that this heritage phenomenon is everywhere in China, but we like to use some sites representing different parts of the of that perspective. So Xi'an refers to the theme of urban heritage. Lijiang focuses on, as Kristina mentioned, on ethnic minority. And Nanjing refers to intangible cultural heritage. And we like to use these sites to cover different parts of heritage in different ways.
Could you give us more of a thumbnail of each of these sites for our listeners, for those who maybe might not be as familiar with China?
Okay, then it's a time for us probably just to have a quick look, go through these examples and cases. First is Xi'an. Chinese cities and its urban development probably reflects one of the most significant perspectives of Chinese modernization, economic development. And in the last decades, we see lots of deconstruction of old neighborhoods in Chinese cities for the sake of replacing them with modern shopping malls, highways, and commercial buildings. But on the other hand, we can also find that lots of historical cities and towns throughout the country, like Beijing, Nanjing, and Shanghai, are redesigning themselves as representation of critical periods in Chinese past. Xi'an is one of them. As an ancient capital of China, Xi'an has undergone large scale of redevelopment by creating updated clean buildings and neighborhoods, which reference to the ancient architecture, streets, and culture. So the city is rebuilding a modern functioning replica of the ancient imperial city of Chang'an. So Chang'an was the ancient name of the city in imperial time. And in addition to those real heritage, such as monuments, city walls, temples, and archaeological, like a Terata army, if you go to Xi'an as the first time as a foreigner, probably you will see all of them. The local authorities also demolished some neighborhoods and rebuilt spacious and beautiful updated neighborhoods and amusement parks with the theme of ancient imperial China. Such a result of spatial production. Echo is what an anthropologist Michael Hertzfeld calls spatial cleansing. When he did his research about the development of cities in Greece and Thailand and Rome, for instance. And such cleansing process benefit to young migrants, tourists, and investors who are interested in all of these beautiful heritage projects while displacing the poor and elder original residents. So you will find that this process leads to a result of gentrification and the social segregation of classes. The case of Xi'an illustrates that the government used public space to stimulate local economy and promote tourism and local real estate industry. Such urban projects favor high middle class interests with the cost of social welfare of the poor and the low class migrants. Communities and individuals often celebrate and accept such state-led spatial production as long as the new living environment does not threaten their personal needs and desires. Christina, would you like to talk about Nanjing?
Yes. So Nanjing is, in a sense, similar to Xi'an because it has a long history of being kind of a cultural hub in the eastern region, producing silk for the imperial court. It has been the capital of China for several times. So on the one hand, it shares this, very kind of more kind of high culture, maybe kind of longstanding tradition in terms of, that are now reflected in heritage sites and cultural practices. But on the other hand, it is also very different because it is located in the very prosperous eastern coast of China, near Shanghai. And it's really a very much economically developed area. And while Yuji looks at or kind of has very much done a lot of research on kind of Xi'an's neighborhoods and kind of more material culture, the Nanjing chapter is more kind of focused on, as you said, intangible cultural heritage. So cultural practices related to handcrafts, performing arts, music, anything like that. And to kind of examine that more closely, we went into museums, but also kind of looking into or speaking with, cultural practitioners. So who are called intangible cultural heritage inheritors. So they kind of live off of, producing, for instance, handcrafts for the tourism industry and or perform, for instance. And so the Nanjing case study provides a different perspective on heritage by focusing on the immaterial forms of heritage. Yuji, do you want to talk about the third case study?
Oh, sure. Thanks, Christina. The third case of the book, as Christina already mentioned in the beginning, that is Lijiang, that represents ethnic minority heritage. Some of the audience might already get familiar with China or Lijiang, this place. It's a city in southwest China, 600 kilometers from the capital of Yunnan, not far from Laos, Burma, and Vietnam. In early days, this is a remote area in which many Western adventurers and explorers were attracted by its mountain sceneries, waterway, wildlife, traditional architecture, and ethnic minority and religious culture. So different from Xi'an and Nanjing, it's a very kind of remote but still very attractive place. However, in 1996, an earthquake struck the region. Right after earthquake, the place was recognized as a UNESCO World Heritage Site, making it even more popular to many Westerners and domestic Chinese. And the government used the post-earthquake reconstruction as an opportunity to recreate a built environment to match early 20th century image of Lijiang to attract investors, migrants, and tourists. And in the meantime, local ethnic tradition and its religious culture has been transformed into cultural product for display and consumption. In this case, we explore the role of cultural heritage in ethnic minority area. And in addition to those similar spatial transformation or intangible heritage, as we mentioned in the Nanjing and Xi'an case, such as beautification and displacement going on, ethnic air heritage in Lijiang also facilitates which we call national civilization project. What does it mean? So on one hand, heritage and its associated ethnic tourism industry facilitates a production of cultural environment where Han Chinese, which is the major population of China, act as a modern and advanced while the indigenous minorities, as we call ethnic minorities, 少数民族, represent the exotic, colorful, authentic, and feminized. And on the other hand, heritage also depoliticize or sometimes even harmonize the ethnic minority culture. Like Lijiang, terms such as unity, integration, and cultural exchange often appear in the official documentation of these ethnic heritage sites. This language legitimized the discourse of historical continuity of Han Chinese culture in these border ethnic minority regions. They also highlight the blending ethnic culture under the Chinese features, a discourse of harmony to promote national unity and Han culture dominance. That's why we call it a civilization project, a project which depoliticizes the ethnic minority discourse, and which can also be found in other ethnic minority areas, such as the Qing Emperor of Chengde, or the recent nomination of the Silk Road. And these are the three, like a quick tour of these three case studies.
Great. And drilling down now, you know, I'd love to learn more about your actual process for researching these sites. How much of it was on the ground? How much of it was literature review? You know, did you conduct interviews? How did you go about this process?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Christina and I have different kind of training backgrounds, so maybe we can both talk a bit about the methods or training. I was trained as an anthropologist, and that requires to stay with one place or community for a long time, which is kind of traditional sense of anthropologist. So we need to study their culture and social life and be for a while and to be closer to them. And so we call to get a sense of being there is crucial. That requires me to hang out with both communities and visitors in their daily life. So for instance, in the workspace, in the tea house, cafe, local market, and restaurants. So I visited several sites many times. And each time I might stay there for 1-2 months, and sometimes 3-4 months if it allows, because I'm traveling overseas, if the funding allows. And during each visit, I met and catch up with old friends and also meet new people and make new friends. And different from traditional anthropological way of staying at a place for at least 1 year, such repetitive visits allows me to understand the impact of heritage on various stages of people's life. So it helped me to understand the transformation rather than only a short period of the place. And Christina, you might have other understanding of your research process.
So I was trained as a political scientist. And I mean, I similarly go, you know, back to you know, sites of my interests. But I often... I engage in more, you know, formal, like semi-structured interviews with people. I often also include government officials, you know, to kind of get, you know, just a government perspective on things. But I also kind of try to include, you know, just experiences like just, you know, participant observation, being, you know, at sites, for instance, talking to vendors, selling handcrafts, being in museums, thinking about what, you know, how, you know, the site is structured, talking to people there. So for me, it's a bit different than you know Ujia, but I think we both have a kind of just a long-term experience in researching this topic in general, but also have long-standing connections with the sites that we have researched. So although we kind of have maybe collected, you know, somewhat different kinds of materials in terms of maybe being more formal or less formal in our conversations, I think it kind of very much speaks to each other, and we still have very much overlapping experiences and can share these. And I think it's really a positive thing to kind of combine these different approaches and disciplinary fieldwork strategies, so to speak, because they give you different perspectives and different, you know, very different kinds of insights. So therefore, I think we very much complement each other in our approaches to doing research on these sites.
And one more thing I'd like to add here is we both, in this research project, we both not only study low, that means we study the community, the place, but we also study high. So we both have a chance to go to high-end heritage conference, sometimes organized by UNESCO or sometimes organized by university academics. These are the places where you also observe as a participant. On one side, you're academic, so you present your research or as a consultant, but on the other hand, that you also understand what is going on as part of that heritage industry.
And that's a great segue into talking about what you observe with the heritage industry or the heritage industrial complex. You observe, you know, what's often called UNESCOization within these sites, how the recognition as a World Heritage Site transforms the space and transforms daily life. Can you explain some of what that was for our listeners, what you experienced, what you observed?
Yes, sure. So one of the key kind of conceptual contributions that we want to make is to make this process of, UNESCOization a bit clearer. So we've kind of conceptualized a five-stage process, which kind of begins with usually the state kind of creating institutions for heritage governance. So this can include laws and policies. It can include a heritage administration. So in China, for instance, you would think of the state administration for cultural heritage that deals with heritage sites, but also the Ministry of Culture and Tourism that is more dealing with intangible heritage. So you have this, you know, kind of a huge setup at the beginning where the state really wants to kind of intervene, so to speak, in the past or in kind of in what is, cultural practices at the ground today or heritage sites or just sites of historical significance, if you will. So this kind of the starting point, this institutionalization, but a kind of a more communal space or, you know, a kind of maybe a more private or communal cultural practice that, you know, wasn't known before, wasn't considered to be heritage before, really becomes heritage when it is authenticated and recognized by, officials. So some kind of these official institutions that have been set up. So, for instance, a local government might, select a few sites or cultural practices for, further research. And then they invite experts to, to see whether this does have some value, there are reasons for preserving this site or this practice. So in the second kind of step of authentication, you want to, see whether a site or a practice is authentic, is valuable. And then in a third step, you then recognize it in some form, usually by putting it on some kind of inventory. So this could be, a list, so a heritage list, such as, a site of historical significance or a 4A, 5A, level or star tourism site. So you somehow create categories and, documentation for these heritage, to make something into a heritage site. Because before it was, just there, just kind of a private communal affair. Now it's something that is officially recognized and turned into something that can be managed through public administration. And through this process of kind of recognizing something, you again then not only authenticate it, but you also usually associate it with some kind of value of, for instance, 4 or 5 stars or national value, local value, because you put it on a local list or a national level heritage list, for instance. And in this process, then something that was more private or communal becomes heritage and therefore also a public good. So something that, you know, belongs to the nation because it's of national significance. Or if you list it at the UNESCO, it becomes heritage of, you know, humanity. So it's something that everybody in the world is interested in and is valued really at the international level. And in the fourth process, then you or kind of the fourth step, you find that once something has become heritage, it is often kind of displayed in some form. So for instance, in museums. So and this is done for educational purposes, for kind of sharing that public good with everyone. It could be, you know, as a in form of kind of leisure activities, but this is really there to kind of to display you know, kind of heritage domestically, internationally. However, because people get interested in and are aware of this heritage as a good once it is displayed, it also attracts attention from people who want to exploit it commercially. So in the fifth step, and this is not always the case, it could be that, for instance, something just remains in a museum, but often heritage actually is then commercialized. For instance, you could think of certain, you know, performing arts kind of shows touring the country, or certain handcrafts suddenly becoming extremely expensive because they have become en vogue, you know, and or just real estate prices going up around a heritage site. So there's a lot of kind of use of heritage in different ways through the tourism industry, cultural industries, but also just as a part of, you know, as Uje just explained, you know, urban redevelopment. So therefore, you can see how something that has, you know, was very vernacular, very local, suddenly becomes heritage and then is used in different ways. And this, we really kind of have identified these five individual steps: institutionalization, authentication, recognition, museumification, and commercialization, kind of to make this clear, make it a bit more explicit. And in the book, we then argue that in these five steps, the kind of this something that was previously just, you know, had no name, was not really identified as heritage, something very communal, is bestowed with value from, you know, that is actually constructed and legitimized at different scales. So for instance, the nation state might, you know, on the basis of being a member of the UNESCO convention, might then say, okay, this is in line with the UNESCO convention. We put this site on a domestic list and will nominate it for inclusion on the World Heritage List. So they kind of, they use the, you know, UNESCO convention as a basis for bestowing value to a heritage site. And the same can be done by local governments, who then kind of use maybe national legislation as a kind of legitimizing force to bestow value on local, you know, practices, festivals. And they say, you know, okay, we will put this on a list and therefore bestow it with value through that. But also non-state actors try to kind of, you know, join that process, have a voice in that process by, you know, trying to, for instance, either use scientific knowledge as experts, kind of try to lobby for something to be considered as heritage because it has, you know, a certain, it's very old, or it has had a huge impact on society. But you find local communities kind of trying to be part of that process, being heard, and wanting to, you know, maybe for instance, lobby for a certain site or practice to be considered as heritage, or to actually themselves use UNESCO concepts, for instance, to try to, you know, demonstrate the value of a certain site or practice.
And it sounds like those community voices often get lost in the process.
It's not necessary. As Christina mentioned nicely of this whole framework, we are not only interested in how heritage is made and produced through that five-stage process: institutionalization, authentication, recognition, museumification, and commercialization. We are also very interested in the different and sometimes contested reception response from the public. especially those, as you mentioned, the voices from the local communities. So we found from our study that many culture practitioners, experts, and entrepreneurs embraced official heritage discourse for often their personal benefits. But not everyone do so. Some local communities often subline or passively accept the idea of heritage, or even sometimes they translate and incorporate the official narrative into something for their own use. So for instance, just give you an example, I found in Xi'an that elders residents surrounding the ancient city wall organized private exhibitions around their home city, about their home city. And such way of heritage practice or commemoration does not refer to the official discourse of glorious Chinese past, which is an official version of heritage. It's rather about their vernacular daily life as a response to the official heritage discourse. Such way of heritage practice is an expression of their emotional anxiety and a loss against the rapid transformation in the local environment. In regards to the response from the local communities, we also find, in addition to embracing or accepting, there are also people use various strategies or ways to resist and sometimes protest the state-led heritage production, such as they do it through online or sometimes on the street. This often happens when their personal interests has been threatened. For example, they found they are not happy with the compensations, or they lost their house or even land through that heritage displacement project. So this analysis leads to a very important finding of this project. So we argue that cultural heritage, due to its associated aesthetic, culture, and economic value, will lead to a relatively easier form of political consent. And as we mentioned, even there's a lot of different response or different voices from the community, and sometimes even they are protested against it. But it's very difficult for people to resist the almost attention of official heritage production. So as long as people's personal needs, such as money or land issues, has been fulfilled, they are often very happy with those national ideology behind cultural heritage. And that's what we call the power of the past as a title of the book, because that's the power of legitimacy as created by cultural heritage.
I do think one of the values of your book is your really sophisticated articulation of the five-stage process for heritage making, which we don't really see spelled out as explicitly in a lot of other places. So I appreciate you covering that. I want to come back to, you mentioned your very different backgrounds, and I imagine wonderfully contrasting work styles. How did you go about the process of collaborating to create this book or to bring this book into the world?
Sure. I personally am very grateful for the process of this collaborative project. As mentioned, Christina and I both are very interested in Chinese cultural heritage, and we have different training backgrounds, but that makes us to see things from different angles. And we really enjoy lots of our conversations through online or actual meetings. So we went to different workshops, conferences. And of course, it's easier in the beginning when we are doing different research and create a lot of joint research interests. It's relatively not easy at the writing phase of the project where we are at two different places. So Christina was that time in London and I'm in Canberra. So I'm very grateful that during the last stage of writing, Christina flew to Canberra and we spent 2 weeks in intensive writing together at a writing camp and complete the draft of the discussion and introduction chapter. Usually that's the last stage of the book. And we really, I mean, that's a very busy writing period, but I think we really have a productive time to complete the most difficult but also depth finding or analysis of the framework which we just presented. Christina, you might have other perception of our journey.
Actually, I absolutely agree. I had a really good time. It was just a lot of fun. And you can really just imagine this as a process of Uji and me talking a lot. you know, discussing a lot, you know, mentioning different perspectives, you know, of course, also sometimes being at odds at, you know, kind of what to include where in the book. And of course, there's always kind of, you know, some compromises and discussions in this area. But I think what has been most productive is that these discussions have really kind of helped us both to spell out, as you said, you know, the implicit knowledge that we have. You know, we kind of both have, you know, researched heritage in China for so long that we wanted to, you know, make this explicit. And by kind of discussing it with each other, we kind of realized, oh, there is actually this process of value appropriation where, you know, people do just on the basis of, you know, for instance, you know, kind of the UNESCO or the national institutions or whatever appropriate value. And that's what Uji just mentioned. That's why people can't resist, because it's so attractive, you know, to get legitimacy and be valued. Everybody wants that, right? And although we have done research on this for so long, it was really, you know, just this kind of just sit there and be like, yes, that's exactly what it is. That's what it boils down to. And although we do have different ways of approaching things, I think it was really this, you know, this coming together, these long discussions, these different perspectives that have helped us to crystallize these key, you know, analytical frameworks on the one hand, but also just key arguments that we develop in the book. So that was just a really, really fun exercise. And I enjoyed it tremendously, Uji. So thank you.
One of the things I always find really amazing about talking with authors is not just what's in the book, but you hit at this, what's not in the book or what you chose to edit, because that's hard. That's not an easy thing, to take something you love out of a book. What were some of the things that you removed or that you kind of put on the back burner for the next book?
In terms of current planning I just had a new book actually coming out soon called Heritage Tourism from Problems to Possibilities, which will be published by Cambridge University Press and hopefully next week, which explores the social and the political effects of an implication of heritage tourism. Back to your question, that which we want to include and it's not there, and I think would be good for the future project or next book. I'm currently working on memory politics and the idea of national forgetting. So lots of things we have covered is relative about the remote past, something beautiful, romanticized, and colorful, and aesthetic pleasing. But also there's a lot of things about recent past. It's not that safe compared to the remote one. It's contested, it's dark, difficult, tragic, which regards to a lot of contested politics. So I'm interested in how national states forget and erase certain difficult problematic pasts for nation building, and also how local communities use private museums and practice to shape that social memory from below. So if you want things that what you want to include or in your future project, I think maybe it's something about national forgetting could be an interesting angle that I like to explore more in the future. And how about you, Christina?
Yeah, I think we definitely discussed this also in regards to what kind of case studies to look at, for instance. So there's so many interesting choices, really. And I think other choices that might be interesting to look at in the future would be to go to areas that are, you know, as Uji just mentioned, maybe have a different sense of, you know, heritage because they are, for instance, in the rust belt of China. They might be now considered to be places of industrial heritage because those new, you know, kind of there's new opportunities for categorizing something as heritage now, and industrial heritage is one of them. But also, what has been really kind of up and coming in the last couple of decades has been like a communist heritage, red culture. And that is really, really fascinating as well. So to think about how the Mao era has become nostalgic and how there's heritage sites related to that. So there's a lot of interesting, you know, other cases to explore, which we just didn't have the time in the scope in the book to discuss these different places. But personally, I've also been a bit more interested lately in the political economy of kind of heritage, looking at commercialization, looking at heritage, you know, products on markets, how they're advertised, what that does to, you know, the kind of this idea of kind of having an authentic, you know, for instance, performance or handcraft, and how these traditional handcrafts can compete with other new products, you know, mass-produced products on the market. So I've been moving on a bit more into this kind of what we touched upon in terms of commercialization. So I think there's a lot of different avenues that we could have explored as well, and that we will explore in the future. I think it's just it's really hard this kind of to make this decision. What do you include? What do you not include? Because there's just so much to talk about.
But you did a great job at coming up with a really concise book. It's short, it's punchy, it has all the key pieces. What did you learn in the process of really editing and drilling down? What did you learn in the process of making this into a book?
I think though Uji and I have been, you know, studying heritage for, you know, for so long, really, and we've often talked about, you know, our ideas and opinions. And then we had this clear idea of a book, you know, to kind of to talk about, you know, what, you know, the politics of heritage. But I think the interesting thing is what I've learned is that even though you might think you're past your PhD level, you do know what you want to write about and you have all of this experience, writing a book is always still very transformative in terms of, especially, you know, if you do it with somebody else, to kind of come up with kind of new ideas. And it's always such a, you know, such a learning process still, even though you think, you know, you know exactly what you want to include. So I think that has been something that was surprising to the extent of which I, you know, further learned and, you know, grew together with Uchiha. So that was really surprising and wonderful.
Yeah, I like your word, Christina, the term transformative. I'm thinking about a better vocabulary, but I think that's a very good one. I totally agree with you, Christina. That's a lot of things is in our mind, but it's not explicitly there. So, but the process of writing together and talking together and working together do make everything more explicit. And transform into a book is part of the process of research. So we saw the research has been done through our different empirical journey, but actually not, because the actual writing part is also a very important stage of research, because a lot of ideas come out at the last stage of that. So I like your word, transformative.
What ideas in that last stage surprised you, if any?
I probably would not call it surprising, because a lot of things we design, we both are very, I would say we both are very kind of Germanic. So we design in the beginning the framework, but a lot of the argument, the key argument come out eventually in the end. But I would say that even in the beginning, because we have different preference of different case study, but eventually it's come a very beautiful landscape of the holistic picture of cultural heritage in China. So I probably would not call it a surprise, but I do think that we both cover different part of perspective of heritage, and in a very coherent way. And I think that that's a very good end. Of course, we probably were adding more things into it for other journal articles and papers. But we do find that book is already complete. And I would not call it a surprise.
And before we started recording, we were talking a bit about the respective COVID responses in our areas. And I don't want to gloss over the challenge of publishing a book during the pandemic. Have you had a chance to, you know, normally, you know, one would be on a book tour or would be visiting universities to really talk about the book, but that's been really changed substantially this year. What was Did you get a sense of the reception? What was that like? How do you feel? What do you feel like it was like to really bring this scholarship into the world at this particular moment?
It was difficult because we did have a few events planned already, and then it was clear that COVID would not make that possible. But we still tried to do what we could. So for instance, just use social media, or we attended online conferences to promote the book as much as we could. But I was very happy that I did see lots of very positive book reviews being published, and the book has been cited a lot so far. So I think it's, to me, surprising has been that although we weren't able to promote the book as much as we wanted to, it has still been really well received by the scholarly community. And I'm happy that people find the book interesting and useful. So yes, maybe you never know what would have happened if COVID hadn't happened. But I'm still very much pleased about how the book has been received overall.
Yeah, I agree. When I saw this question, I did a bit of research. I mean, even before that, I didn't go to that part about reception. As Krista mentioned, we don't really have the chance to do organize official book launch. Maybe we hope we can do it. And very happily to see Christina again after launching the book, or when we launched the book. But I just saw actually there was a review was published probably last month, and I'm happy to share with you, Christina. It was very positive, and I just quickly go through that, saying that the book was as a must read about associations between dynamic political discourse and daily practice in the present rhythm of heritage in China. And so I'm very happy to see the reception of that. And also it's being widely cited around the world, even just after 1 year of publication. So we are very happy about that.
You should be, though. You shouldn't be surprised by it, I have to say. Process for value appropriation is one that I can easily imagine being on slides in every single heritage management introductory course, right? It's very useful and very very transferable set of knowledge that doesn't just cover these particular sites, but also covers the larger area of heritage making and heritage identification. So I've taken up a lot of your time, and I appreciate your generosity in talking with this book and joining me from different time zones from across the world. For our listeners who I would strongly recommend read this book, where can they learn more about your other work, or where can they find out more about your scholarship?
Yes. So I have a University of Sheffield website. I'm at Sheffield at the moment. And I have, of course, a list there. I also have a Google Scholar account, just where you can find everything. The usual places, I would say, also on academia.edu or ResearchGate. So I think if you just type in Ujers or my name into Google Scholar, I think you'll find a lot, because we've published quite a lot on this topic. So or just get in touch. Feel free to just let us know if there's anything that is of particular interest.
And actually, in researching this, I did exactly that, and I found a really helpful lecture from you, Yuja, from Cornell. I think it was in 2016, that gave a wonderful crash course to heritage fever and to this phenomenon in China.
Oh, that's right. You were there. I didn't realize it.
No, I didn't get to physically attend the video, but I got to see the video, which is very helpful for framing the book. And I think that's a
right
scholarship.
Right. And later I used that as a teaching material, and which I found also very useful. So we never waste the opportunity for online materials these days during the COVID period.
Well, thank you again for joining me on New Books in Law.
Thank you very much, Nick. It's our pleasure to be here, and even in different time zones. And it's already our pleasure to discussing our books. Thank you
for having us. It was a pleasure as well.
All right, Eugene and Christina, stay safe.
You too. Stay
safe
in New York, and enjoy enjoy freedom, hopefully soon.